see if it's, there we go, of my history is that I was trained as a climbing guide, as a mountaineering guide. And as part of that training, spent a fair bit of time just sort of living in places where there aren't things like houses. And some of the climbing trips that I had a chance to be on were kind of longer. And so you wouldn't just kind of put everything you needed in one backpack and take off and go do your trip and come back. You had to actually make your way into the range you were going to climb in and establish a base camp there and then work from there. And sort of this multi-day process of getting things to a base camp. But what we would often do for some of those longer climbs, some of which would have been about a month in duration, is kind of in a series of events, not unlike last Sunday, we would carry all these loads of the things we need into the base camp area, and then we'd set up this humongous orange tent that was big enough to house everybody. If you kind of all just came in there and sat down cross-legged, everybody from the whole team could fit into this thing. And that was base camp. And that was a pretty important place. This interesting thing about base camp was its intent, because its intent, no pun intended, thank goodness, because that would be horrid. Its intent was that not that we would stay there. It wasn't home in that sense of the word, but it was kind of an anchor point. It was a place to regroup. It was a place to celebrate certain kinds of things. It was a place sometimes to mourn certain kinds of things. It was a place to replenish some aspects of the human person, but there were other aspects, of course, that were fueled much better by not being there, but by being out on whatever the adventure was that we actually went into the mountains to have. And so when I was thinking about this place this week, I thought kind of what I wanted to say to us out of that story was welcome to base camp, not welcome home. It's a different idea. We need places as humans to group and regroup. We need places to gather. That's really important. The things that can happen when we do this are unique, and we need them. They're legitimate. I'm not trying to pull the plug on that. But I am trying to say, at the same time, that's different than feeling like this is the adventure we came for. This is something that can help us be ready, or more ready, if you will, for the adventure that we came for. But this is not the adventure that we came for. This is some place, something from which we go to do what we are here to do. And I think that's important. I know I'll probably overcook my caution about this, and so let me just say that I'm aware that I might be hyper-attenuated to the problem. And then you can just, I don't know, forgive me or not, right? But either way, self-awareness, I think, is helpful sometimes, in a limited way at least. But with that disclaimer, I think that if, as a community, we exist to explore spiritually, then anything that would cause us to step away from that is something that causes us to step away from our reason for being, from this particular community's reason for being. I would extend that argument. I would say the church's reason for being. I could be quite adamant about this idea and quite sweeping with it, but it's not really in my purview to say that to the church. It is in my purview to say it to us as a community, so I will. That's what we say. This is what we exist to do. We exist to make room to explore what we believe. So this is an aspect of that, and an important one. And I think it was Ray who said to me this morning, I was walking around grinning, we were trying to figure out, as it turns out right at that moment, we were trying to still solve the question of phone lines, which, although this building has several, they seem to be set up in a way that doesn't allow our debit machine to work. And so we're going to solve that, and you know, we'll get there, and that's all good. But we were in the middle of that, and I was walking around with this big smile on my face, and Ray said to me, you know that old saying about if something seems too good to be true, it probably is? I said, oh no, this isn't too good to be true. There's still problems to be solved. This is still real. Like, this is still, we still belong here, you know? And to me, that's why I was grinning. Not because I'm happy that we couldn't solve that problem, because
between frame and our move, I think we're now sort of like 3 weeks into that problem, and at some point this gets to be a functional problem for us. So we'll get there. But I was grinning because it felt really consistent with why we exist. And it was really delightful to me to just watch people run around the place this morning as we came in and just keep working at what started last week with the move. A big thank you to those of you that were able to be here and stay last week and help with that. I know there were people that wanted to that couldn't as well, and that's all good. We had a good crew, and we were actually moved out of frame faster than we usually clean up. So the motivation and the horsepower worked well together, and we got everything over here, and that's awesome. And we'll just keep moving in. If you haven't had a chance to yet, it's worth wandering down the stairs and around the corner just to get a little glimpse of what the kids get to enjoy in the rest of the space, because in a lot of ways that was a deep motivator for what we did, and there's lots there that's good. Lots to still be done, things we need, and all of that. I don't think any of that, for me, none of that kind of guts the celebration. And throughout the week, it was fascinating. People just showed up here with things that we needed. And by the way, if you have assignments or you have things that you want to bring or things that we've agreed you're going to bring here, when Independent Jewelers is open for business, you could come in and bring them into this space. Like, you don't have to arrange that with me. So just so you know, they're open for business. John, what are your hours at this time of the year? So that's a fair bit of access without having to make any special arrangements. So there you go, if you're bringing things by that are needed for the community. And just a quick poll here, just while we're doing some housekeeping. Things that we still need. Anybody can jump into this. Karen? We're doing really well.
So many things just appeared.
Yeah. Maybe even hard to know what all arrived here in the past week. Kid stuff, the change table, playpen for napping kind of business. Where are we at with that?
We have a playpen now.
Okay.
I think the change table is the only thing that's really missing from there.
Okay.
Maybe a lamp, so it's not just all lights and lights.
Yeah. Could everybody hear that? Okay. So there you go, and we'll kind of keep you posted. I don't know when this happened.
I haven't seen that since a couple moves in.
Apparently we once again need a coffee grinder. So there you go.
John?
Yes, a mirror for the bathroom.
Okay. I was going to say, if you are bringing stuff during our business hours, to maybe just let one of the ladies in our giftware section know. Don't just treat mine if they're up there.
Thank you.
Like, hey, who are you?
Yeah.
Just let them know you're the table church. We do kind of block it off with very high-tech security tables.
Try not to smash anything you don't want to own on the way in or out. Okay?
Just maybe, and I'll be here all week this week, so just let someone know what you're doing.
Okay. Thank you, John. Independent Jewelers has been more than kind in all of this, so anything we can do to, just like with frame, anything we can do that has to do with integration and cooperation around our space, let's go out of our way to do that in the community. That still feels like the least we can do to let our benefactors know that we're grateful. So John and his brother and father now have the unique privilege of functioning in the 21st century for this community, roughly as the Medicis did in the Renaissance. Except we're hoping they're not going to take control of everything we do.
For bringing things, is somebody coordinating so we don't get like tons of one thing and then nothing of another?
No, we're just taking our chances, Bernie. That's an excellent question, and that's my honest answer. Okay. This is sort of that point right here where we kind of go, that everything that was on that list that we sent out, we now have some version of, I think, with the exception of what Karen mentioned this morning about another playpen. So I think we're kind of caught up on essentials. We have more than one mop, for instance, and more than one vacuum. So, you know, there's some redundancy, but given the age and vintage of the vacuums, I think that's probably a good thing. That's not a slight. I brought one of them. A second rocking chair?
If it's possible.
Yeah. So if anybody else, if somebody brought a rocking chair, couch, tables, chairs. Wow. Fabulous. Somebody else in the community bought a bunch more of these chairs. It looks as though we could, in fact, use a few more chairs. A confession and a gift, all at once. Thank you. So there we go. What I want us to take a few moments to do, and I'm going to reflect on some other of the things that I said in the blurb. But I want us to take a moment to pray a prayer of blessing over this place in a deliberate way. This place that is sort of the base camp for our next season of exploration. So I will lead us in that, and I will pray the first part of the prayer on our behalf, and then the part we're going to pray together will come up on the screen, and we'll pray the blessing of the community on this place aloud together. All right? So let's pray. May God give a blessing on this place. God bless it from roof to floor, from wall to wall, from end to end, from its foundation and in its covering, in the strong name of the triune God. All evil be banished, all disturbance cease, captive spirits freed. God's spirit alone dwell within these walls. Together, we call upon the sacred three to save, shield, and surround this building, this business, this day, this night, and every day and night. Peace be here in the name of the King of Life, the peace of Christ above all peace, the Lord's blessing over all. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. I have found it interesting how both in our group and our individual conversations when we were planning this move, some of what was voiced, and we had a really good community time around it before we did it as part of the process of deciding, some of what was voiced in that conversation could legitimately be described or connected to the emotion that I would call fear. And I don't think that's unusual in change. I don't say that critically, but we talked about fears about the temporary nature of the arrangement. We talked about fears about safety concerns. We talked about some fears having to do with liability concerns. We talked about some fears that could be generally described as being connected to what the future would hold. And we could keep going. There were things like that that were part of that conversation. And most of what I want to focus on for the remaining part of my portion of the morning, I'm going to characterize fear as something that we need to face into and ultimately something that we should be without. It's worth remembering, though, in that description, that fear is also something that keeps us alive. Fear is something that's sort of primal. It keeps us from jumping off both metaphoric and literal cliffs, you know, that kind of thing. There's a healthy part about fear, and I'm not being blithe about that. And we have those kind of fears for a reason, and we need to pay attention to those, and we need to try to get at their roots, because those fears often have something to say to us that we need to hear as individuals and as a community. So we just need to learn how to pay attention and do our work. Like going underneath those things and going, where did that come from? And then we either need to deal with them or sort of deflect them and dismiss them and go, that's just bark, bark. Like, that's just noise. I don't need to attend to that. I can ignore it. Or to figure out how to, in some cases, how to carry those fears, how to live with them with some grace. Because some of the things that we fear are not either easily dealt with or dismissed. You know, they have some horsepower. That said, in the Christian tradition, we have somebody sort of no less a luminary than the Apostle Paul saying that perfect love casts out fear. And so in the season of Advent, when we get to this sort of part of the story where God's angel kind of rips out of the night sky to break the news about Jesus being born, and he says, I'm using the masculine pronoun out of habit, says to the cowering shepherds, "Fear not." I think it's important to recognize from the outset that that's not just a birth announcement. That's not just some barked-out instruction to a bunch of cowering, bottom-of-the-social-rung people to get up off their face and do something. But it is, in fact, both a beginning and an ending. And here's what I mean by that. It seems to me that it's a really legitimate reading of the angel's words, you know, bring your great tidings, glad tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. It seems to me that it's a legitimate reading of that to understand that one of the things it means, one of the things the angel is saying to the shepherds and to us, is that over the course of time,
the grip that fear has on our human hearts is going to be displaced by a greater power. It's going to be displaced by the power of love. And so when the sky opens and there's this alarming spectacle of these swirling, pronouncing beings, the words "fear not" mark the advent. They mark the beginning of Jesus as the God-man, but they also mark the end of fear. Maybe don't try to tell that to the shepherds, hey? Because I don't think it's an unreasonable piece of speculation to think that fear was no small part of their experience in that moment. But then again, in our human experience, generally, the cohabitation of love and fear are not all that novel. For me, the high water mark of the cohabitation of love and fear would be being present at the complicated birth of all four of my kids. You want to be in a room where love and fear are both in full flight. To me, that's that room, you know. There are other examples, I know, but if we dig around a bit in our fears, if I dig around a bit in my fear in that those moments in my own memory, what we often find, what I often find, is that what I'm afraid of, the fear that's underneath the emotion, the big, powerful, below the waterline, hefty thing, is that I am afraid of death, or something that feels like death. Death shakes us. We live in a curious age in this regard. A few months ago, the cover of Maclean's magazine had this picture, I don't know if you saw this, of this tremendously cute baby, and the slug basically said something to the effect of how this child is going to live to such and such an age, they're going to live this much longer than the previous generations. And then a couple months later, the cover photo on the same magazine was a photograph of an aging boomer walking alone into a sunset, and the headline said that the boomers are doomed. And if you dug into the articles, the first one, the whole issue commented on how much longer we're living, longer than any humans in the history of what we would, in the, that's okay, what we would, in, living.
The boomers comment.
Yeah, right on cue there, my friend. That we're living longer than any humans have in what we Westerners call the history of humanity. And if you dug into the second issue, what you found were a bunch of articles that bemoan how our longer life means that we're aging and facing death alone, that we're well-resourced financially, but we're bereft of deep family and community ties, and doomed, the doomedness is to living a long time and dying alone. So maybe the Beatles weren't just a seminal rock band. Maybe they were actually onto something bigger when they sang "Can't Buy Me Love." And even though as humans we seem to be getting better and better at sort of extending our best before date for our human experience, in the end, we face and fear death. So when we're just working along at life, when we're tending to our affairs as best we can, when we're sort of herding whatever sheep seem to be ours to herd, and the sky of life kind of rips open in some incomprehensible or alarming event, or the phone rings with an unanticipated pronouncement, or whatever it is that stuns us and sort of leaves us face down, what do we do? And in this story of the angel's pronouncement to the shepherds, I'm intrigued that the shepherds don't stay on the ground quaking. They don't stay curled up in the fetal position, sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop, the shoe that's going to actually finally squash them out of existence. And when I wrote that in my notes, there was a little thing that went off in my head that said, Tim, don't forget, when you say that, when you use that language to say, I'm not talking here about depression, okay? I'm talking about cataclysm. There are enough of us in this room or in any room where humans gather that know what it's like to be curled up in that position and have part of us say, I need to move, and another part of us that seems to be winning say, you can't. That's not what I'm talking about. That's a different matter than being leveled by the sky tearing open with what is unexpected, although one can certainly lead to the other. In that story that I'm referring to, though, I find something quite heartening about the shepherd's response but rather than staying leveled is, well, let's go and see. Let's go and see. And to me, that kind of has that kind of has the ring of, well, since we're up anyway, you know. I don't know, does this happen to anybody else in the room? You wake up at 4 in the morning because you went to sleep working and your brain didn't actually stop. You were just exhausted, and so you actually get, you know, 3 or 4 hours of sleep, and then at 4 in the morning, whatever, you wake up and you're still working. And you kind of have that moment where you go, okay, so I could lay here and toss and turn for the next couple of hours and see if I could sleep some more, or I could just admit that I'm not going to and get up and, I don't know, read, work, organize the whole block's life because I've got this much extra. You know what I mean? That's what this kind of feels like to me. Well, you know, the angels showed up and tore the sky open and we're all awake, man. So let's go see. Life is disrupted. Let's go look at the disruption. Let's go face the damn thing already. Maybe we can get some sleep. Or maybe it'll turn out to be worth getting up for. Who can say? We just have to go see. And I know that doesn't sound very spectacular or glorious or heroic, but that's how it rings to me. And maybe the reason it rings that way for me is because when I try to imagine myself in the shepherd's space, one of the possibilities that they have to face into is that whatever else is going on in this cataclysm, whatever else is going on in this sky-rending, life-altering, leveling moment, one of the possibilities is that it isn't the end. One of the possibilities is that this is something more like a beginning. It's not foregone. See, we're reading the story backwards like we always do, right? It's like reading the last page of the novel. Some of us have grown up hearing the last page of the novel over and over and over again. So it's like, that story doesn't mean anything because I already know how it ends. Can I just say that if we've grown up with that, we've had the novel misread? Because the last printed page isn't the last page in the story at all. Anyway, another day. But lots of us have grown up with that. And it makes it hard to pay attention to what's actually going on in the story, right? For the shepherds, this is not normal, what's happening. Whatever it is that's happening that the writer's trying to describe, it's not normal. But normal wasn't that great anyway. So can we just be honest about that? Because the shepherds are not living the good life in their cultural context. They're not out there with the sheep in the main because they can't think of a better way to live. These are not romantic nomads. These are not people who went to the hills to herd sheep to simplify their overcluttered 21st century consumer-oriented life. They're out there in the hills because that's where the culture put them and they can't have another way to live. But it's not the heap of the pinnacle of any heap that anyone would want to be on that they're on. And so when the sky rips open and things get, what, worse? They're sure not normal. Do you get how the shepherds might just have gone, huh? Huh? Let's go see. You know? I didn't want to be up at this hour. I was trying to get a little sleep because the sheep are just going to do what they do again tomorrow and I'm going to have to just do what I do again tomorrow and this is life. And so let's go check this out. And I know that doesn't sound like it belongs in the creche, you know? I know that doesn't sound like it belongs in the airbrushed version of the story. But if we keep trying to airbrush the story, we're just going to kind of miss what it has to say. To those of us who've had life ripped open. What if facing the unknown for better is head on, for better or worse, is actually an improvement over huddling up in the fear of death? What if what is happening here is the beginning of the end of living as though death was the ultimate bad guy? What if whatever the angel is talking about when the angel says, you should go and see what's going on? What if facing that unknown thing that has come into my life unbidden and rocked my world right to its roots, what if going to face that terrible fear is better than living with the fear of death hamstringing every decision that I make? What if?
I don't know if you know anybody that seems to live like they aren't afraid of death. Maybe you've had the privilege of being with someone like that when they died. That is awesome. There are some people like this in the world, it seems to me. I read a story this past week about a guy who was known to those who knew him well as Father Mike, but his full name was Michael Judge. Father Mike was a Franciscan priest. He was a fire department chaplain. He is also in history, in Western contemporary history, he will be forever marked as the first registered victim at Ground Zero in the Twin Towers. It's an interesting story because the details of his death aren't exactly clear. There are some who remember him as remember seeing him fatally wounded while he was administering last rites to a dying firefighter. That has a certain poetic shape to it that's undeniable. There are others that remember him standing alone in silent prayer. What we know is, however he died, his lifeless body was found in the lobby and it was carried to a nearby church just before Tower 1 collapsed. So that's what we know about how he died. But it's how this guy lived that got my interest piqued. This is a guy who, he was a fire department chaplain. He poured himself into his work. He loved his work. He was also an outspoken advocate for people with AIDS. He was known throughout the city for his love of those with less. He had this interesting habit of asking people that he knew had money if they'd give him their dollar bills, whatever they had in their wallet, just, you know, their spare dollars, and he'd put them in his pocket. So he always had a pocket full of that size of money so that when people asked him for money that were living on the street, he always had some money. I guess he was always liberating people's change, which I kind of liked. I thought that was good. And he was well known in at least one neighborhood for this incident where he climbed up a fire ladder to a second-story window to talk a frenzied gunman into surrendering to the police, which is, you know, not the sort of thing you do if you're trying to live in a way that keeps you far from the possibility of dying. And if you know me at all, you know I'm not the kind of preacher to roll out a hero story. And that's not least of all because I think that the story we're exploring and that we're living in insists that the good news of the story is for ordinary people. So I'm not telling you Father Mike's story to use up our time and space with a narrative about a super first person. I'm telling you his story because, although in retrospect his job might seem like an extraordinary one, most of his life, like most of ours, was comprised of ordinary moments, ordinary choices, the kind of things that form the habits that then inform the way that we act, whatever life brings. And it strikes me that this was a guy who had faced his own Ground Zero long before he stood in the lobby of Tower 1 trying to decide what to do with that moment. It seems likely to me, although I have no way of knowing this, that this was a person that didn't think of God as a last resort, as the one that we turn to when the sky is falling, but rather as a presence in the world that invites us to go and see. George MacDonald, the guy who gave us the genre that gave us Lord of the Rings, among other things, if you will. George MacDonald once wrote that when tragedy strikes, when the fabric of everyday life tears wide open, we too often, and this is the quote, MacDonald says, in those moments we too often look upon God as our last and feeblest resort. We go to him because we have nowhere else to go. Now the good news is that even if we do that, we will find a warm and welcome embrace. But what if instead of that, we recall the message that came with the rending of the sky, with the cataclysm of the angels? What if, rather than God being our last resort, we recall this message of fear not? What if, when we're faced with the uncertainties of life, we include in our view of the world the possibility that God is always with us, always seeking to draw us close, even as the psalmist says, if what we're experiencing feels to us like the depths of hell? What if? MacDonald also wrote that once we do turn to God, we will find that the storms of life have, quote, driven us not upon the rocks, but into our desired haven. Now that's an interesting idea. I don't like this idea because I don't like what it says about me, and this is all about me. one of the things that I think is so potent about that idea is the possibility that without cataclysm, I can't seem to face the possibility that the thing I desire most is actually not to defeat death on my own, but to give in and be taken into the safety of a much bigger idea, which is the idea that's all wrapped up in what the angels are trying to say when they say, fear not. And I realize the danger of that way of thinking, among other things, is that God becomes the one who causes cataclysm, that God causes suffering. I'm not going to take that dilemma on this morning. That's enormous. I know they're deeply connected, those two thoughts. But here's the thing. One of the things that I love about what we now call the Christmas story is the way that it's integrally woven together with the story of Easter. I think one of the reasons our culture has just gutted this story is because we've divorced those two narratives, and they're not actually divorced at all. Because for all that the Christmas story is one of new birth, and that's what the angels come to announce, that's the context for them when they say fear not. The bigger context is that the one that shows the way to live in the Christian narrative is the one that faces death, the ultimate fear, head on. See, in the Christmas story, the hero is kind of an anti-hero, because this is the person, this is the being that not only faces death, but has to live with the fear of it, has to live with the agony of it in the story, in the narrative, in horrendous and brutal detail. I don't know any, and I use the term advisedly, I don't know any sane person in our culture that actually lives with the fear of crucifixion as a daily possibility. And not only does the anti-hero of the story face that fear, but they die. But again, that's not the last word in the story. Because the next word in the story is resurrection, and that is the word that is the fulfillment of the angels' fear not, because it is the possibility, the improbable but wondrous possibility, that means that in each of our lives, death is not the last word. That's what the angels are talking about. And that is what makes the idea of living in the way of Jesus worth considering at all, it seems to me. But here's the thing. Giving an intellectual nod to this idea of resurrection doesn't mean that suddenly we don't know fear or that we're not going to face death. That's not what it means. We still have to figure out, we still have to choose how we will live in light of that. And I think what it comes down to is choosing to live life in such a way that its meaning cannot be taken away by death. I think that's the realm we get to operate in. That's where we get to be choosers and actors. See, the core of that choice to live that way, to live in such a way that the meaning of my life can't be taken away by death, the core of that choice is for me to choose to fight the impulse to live for myself. Because in the end, that's a self-protective strategy that just doesn't work. If we happen to be having a delusional moment about that, and we think that that strategy will work, all we have to do is pick up the McLean's magazine and read about the doom of the boomers. Because I'm a boomer, we are arguably the most self-protective generation in the history of humanity. I mean, maybe that's too grandiose. Maybe we're making too much of ourselves here. But we've done a pretty bang-up job of making sure the parachute's golden and the cushion is big and fat, and we're going to be just fine, right? We're going to be just fine as we die alone. We're all resourced right to the end of our doomed life. Ah, great. What does it mean to live in a way that death can't rob of meaning? What does it mean? It means things like this. It means things like wrestling with how we choose generosity over greed. That's hard. It means things like working toward living humbly rather than seeking influence and power. That's complicated, because you can do good things with influence and power. What does it look like when somebody lives humbly and they have influence and power? Or you could do worse than look to the current pope to have some instruction on that. It's an intriguing, challenging idea.
And I suppose in the end, you know, to live like this is to practice dying again and again to our own self-serving opinions and our own preferred agendas. And that's hard too. But I think that's the kind of idea that's perking away underneath the story like the one about Father Mike. I think when we face the mini cataclysm of not putting ourselves first, when we face head-on the little death of pouring out our lives on behalf of others, we are more or less doing what the shepherds did when they got up off their faces and they went down to see what has come to pass. Same thing. Different setting. We're choosing to face the possibility that going to have a deep personal look at what it's like when God is present on earth. We're facing the real possibility that when we look that thing straight in the face, it just might unravel us. It just might wreck our fine little plan. At which point, I think it's worth remembering that our fine little plan doesn't seem to have managed to undo our fear of death. Man. But when we make that choice to go look deep into the face of that possibility, we are also choosing to face the possibility that this is, in fact, the best way to live, because it is the way that frees us to love and to not be afraid. Peace.